warming. I find myself smiling, and then I begin to laugh, and then instantly feel disappointed in myself. I shouldn't be enjoying anything that Solitaire is doing. But also, this is the first time in my life that I have ever felt a positive emotion toward Year 7. Chapter 5. I'm on my way home on the bus when Michael finally decides to make his dramatic reappearance. I'm sitting in the second seat from the back on the left, downstairs, listening to Elvis Costello like the goddamn hipster I am, when he spontaneously cycles up beside me on his mouldy old bike so that he is rolling down the road at the same speed as the bus. The window that I'm looking out of is all grimy and the snow has dried water droplets into it, but I can still see his smug old face in profile, grinning in the wind like a dog hanging its head out of the car. He turns, searching along the windows, eventually realizing that I am, in fact, directly adjacent to him. Hair billowing, coat flapping behind him like a cape, he waves freakishly and then slaps his hand so hard on the window so that every stupid kid on the bus stops throwing whatever they're throwing and looks at me. I raise my own hand and wave, feeling quite ill. He keeps this up until I get off the bus 10 minutes later, by which time it has started to snow again. I tell Nick and Charlie that they can go on without me. When we're alone, we sit on a garden wall, Michael propping his bike up against it. I notice that he isn't wearing his school uniform. I look to my left, up at his face. He's not looking at me. I wait for him to start the conversation, but he doesn't. I think he's challenging me. It's taken longer than it should for me to recognize that I want to be around him. I say, forcing the words out. Sorry. He blinks as if confused, turns to me, and smiles gently. It's okay, he says. I nod a little and look away. We've done this before, haven't we? He says. Done what? The awkward apology thing. I think back to the manically depressed psychopath comment. This isn't the same, though. That was me being stupid and his anger getting the better of him. That was just words. I didn't know Michael at all back then. Michael still has that spark, that light, but there's more there now. Things that cannot be seen, only found. Where have you been? I ask. He looks away and chuckles. I got suspended for Monday afternoon, yesterday and today. This is so ridiculous that I actually laugh. Did you finally give someone a nervous breakdown? He chuckles again, but it's weird. That could probably happen, to be fair. His face changes. No, yeah, I swore at Kent. I snort. You swore? You got suspended because you swore? Yep, he scratches his head. Turns out Higgs has some sort of policy on that. The land of oppression, I nod, quoting Becky. So how did that happen? It sort of started in history, I guess. We had our mock mocks a couple of weeks ago, and we got our marks on Monday. And my teacher held me back after the lesson because, predictably, I did really badly. I think I legitimately got an E or something. So she started having a real go at me, you know, raving on about how much of a disappointment I am and how I don't even try. That's when I started to get pretty annoyed because, like, I clearly tried. But she kept going on, and she held up my essay and pointed at it and was like, What do you think this is? Nothing in this makes sense. Where's your point evidence explanation? Where's your PEE? Basically, she ended up taking me to Kent's office like I was some primary school kid. He pauses. He isn't looking at me. And Kent started his big speech about how I should be better than this, and I'm not committing enough to schoolwork, and I'm not putting in enough effort. And I tried to defend myself, but you know what Kent's like. As soon as I started trying to reason with him, he got all aggressive and patronizing, which made me even more angry, because, you know, teachers simply cannot admit to a student that they could possibly be wrong. And then, like, I didn't mean to, but I was like, you don't even fucking care though, do you? And, yeah, I got suspended. This reminds me of the Michael who Nick described the first day of term. But instead of finding this story a little strange, I actually feel pretty impressed. What a rebel, I say. He gives me a long look. Yes, he says, I'm awesome. Teachers really don't care, though. Yeah, I should have known that, really. We both return to staring at the row of houses opposite. The windows are all orange from the setting sun. I scuff my shoes on the snowy pavement. I kind of want to ask him about his skating. But at the same time, I feel like that's his thing, his special private thing. I've been pretty bored without you, I say. There is a long pause. Me too, Michael says. Did you hear about what the Year 7s did today? Yeah, that was hilarious. I was there. I always sit on the field Wednesday, period 5, so I was literally right there. It was like, it was raining streamers or something. He seems to stop moving. After a few seconds, he turns his head slowly toward me. That was a lucky coincidence, he says. It takes me a minute to get what he's saying. It's ridiculous. Solitaire would have no way of knowing that I always skip that lesson and sit on the field. Teachers hardly notice most of the time. It's ridiculous. But I start thinking about what Michael said before. About Star Wars, Material Girl, the cats, the violin, and the Ben Hope attack. That was about my brother. But it's impossible. I'm not special. It's entirely impossible. But there have been a lot of coincidences. Yeah, I say, just a coincidence. We both stand up and start to walk along the gradually whitening path, Michael pushing his bike along beside him. It leaves a long grey line behind us. Little white dots of snow rest in Michael's hair. What now? I ask. I'm not quite sure which now I'm talking about. This minute? Today? The rest of our lives? Now? Michael considers my question. Now we celebrate and rejoice in our youth. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? I find myself grinning. Yes. Yes, that is what we're supposed to do. We walk a little farther. The snow grows from a light sprinkling to flakes as large as 5 pence pieces. I heard about what you said to Becky, he says.
Who told you?
Charlie.
Who told Charlie?
He shakes his head. I don't know.
When did you talk to Charlie?
He avoids my eye. The other day, I just wanted to make sure you were all right.
What, do you think I'm depressed or something?
I say this much too angrily. I don't want people to be worried about me. There's nothing to worry about. I don't want people to try and understand why I am the way I am.
because I should be the first person to understand that. And I don't understand yet. I don't want people to interfere. I don't want people in my head picking out this and that, permanently picking up the broken pieces of me. If that's what friends do, then I don't want any. He smiles, a proper smile. Then he laughs. You really cannot accept that people care. I don't say anything. He's right, but I don't say anything. He stops laughing. Several minutes pass in silence. I start to think about 4 weeks ago, when I didn't know Michael, when solitaire hadn't happened. I am aware that I feel sadder about things now. A lot of things around me have been very sad, and I seem to be the only one who can see it. Becky, for example. Lucas. Ben Hope. Solitaire. Everyone is okay with hurting people. Or maybe they cannot see that they are hurting people. But I can. The problem is that people don't act. The problem is that I don't act. I just sit here doing nothing, assuming that someone else is going to make things better. Eventually, Michael and I end up at the edge of town. It's getting dark now, and more than one street lamp flickers on as we pass, casting a yellow glow across the ground. We walk down a wide alley between two large houses and break out into the fields, slick with snow, that stretch between the town and the river. Whites, greys, blues, everything is a blurry mist. Rain on the windscreen. A painting. I stand there. It all kind of stops, like I've left Earth, like I've left the universe. It's beautiful, I say. Don't you think the snow is beautiful? I expect Michael to agree with me, but he doesn't. I don't know, he says. It's just cold. It's romantic, I guess. But it just makes things cold. Chapter 6. So, Tori, Kent scans his eyes over my next essay. What was your opinion this time? It's Friday lunchtime. I didn't really have anything to do, so I came to give in my next English essay early. To what extent is marriage the central concern of Pride and Prejudice? It appears that Kent is talkative today, my least favourite character trait. I wrote a normal essay. I thought you might, he nods. I still want to know what you thought. I try to think back to when I wrote it. Monday lunch? Tuesday? All the days blur into one. Do you think marriage is the central concern? It's a concern, not the central concern. Do you think that Elizabeth cares about marriage at all? I picture the film. I think she does, but it doesn't really occur to her when she's with Darcy. Like, she doesn't relate the two together, Darcy and marriage. They're two separate problems. Then what would you consider to be the central concern of Pride and Prejudice? Themselves. I put my hands in my blazer pocket. They spend the whole thing trying to merge who they really are and who they're seen as. Kent nods again, as if he knows something that I don't. That's interesting. Most people say that love is the main theme, or the class system. He puts my essay in a cardboard folder. Do you read many books at home, Tori? I don't read. This seems to surprise him. Yet you decided to take English literature A-level. I shrug. What do you do for fun, Tori? Fun? Surely you have a hobby. Everyone has a hobby. I read, for example.
My hobbies are drinking diet lemonade and being a bitter asshole. I used to play the violin.
Ah, you see, a hobby.
I don't like the implications of the word hobby. It makes me think of crafts or golf, something that cheerful people do. I gave it up, though.
Why?
I don't know. I just didn't enjoy it much. Kent nods for the 100th time, tapping his hand on his knee.
That's fair.
What do you enjoy? I like watching films, I guess.
What about friends? Don't you like being with them?
I think about it. I should enjoy being with them. That's what people do. They hang around with friends for fun. They have adventures, and they travel, and they fall in love. They have fights, and they lose each other, but they always find each other again. That's what people do.
Who would you consider to be your friend?
I again take my time to think and make a list in my head. Michael Holden, most qualified candidate for friend status. Becky Allen, was best friend in past, but obviously no more. Lucas Ryan, see above. Who else was my friend before this? I can't really remember.
Things certainly are a lot easier the fewer friends that you have.
Kent sighs, folding his arms against his tweed jacket.
But then, friendship comes with a lot of benefits.
I wonder what he is talking about.
Are friends really that important?
He clasps his hands together.
Think about all the films you've seen. Most of the people who do well and turn out happy have friends, yes? Often it's just one or two very close friends. Look at Darcy and Bingley, Jane and Elizabeth, Frodo and Sam, Harry, Ron and Hermione. Friends are important. People who are alone are usually the antagonists, like Voldemort.
Even Voldemort had followers, I argue. But the word followers just makes me think about my blog.
Followers, yes. Friends? Real friends? Definitely not. You can't always rely just on yourself, even though it can seem like an easier way to live.
I disagree, so I choose not to say anything.
Kent leans forward.
Come on, Tori. Snap out of it. You're better than this.
Better than what? Sorry my grades haven't been good.
Don't be dumb. You know this isn't about that.
I frown at him.
He frowns right back, a sarcastic frown.
Get a grip. It's time for you to stand up. You can't continue to let life's chances just drift by.
I stand up out of the chair and turn around to leave. As I open the door, he murmurs,
"Nothing's going to change until you decide you want it to change."
I shut the door behind me,
wondering if I just imagined this entire conversation.
Chapter 7. Last period is a free period, so I sit in the common room. I keep looking at Becky, who's working at another table, but she doesn't look at me. Evelyn is also there. She stays on her phone for the entire hour. I check my blog, and there's a message.
Anonymous. Thought for the day. Why do people believe in God?
I check the solitaire blog, and the top post at the moment is a gif of a little boy blowing bubbles out of one of those plastic pots. A barrage of bubbles burst into the air and up into the sky, and the camera looks up at them, and sunlight shines through, lighting them up pink and orange and green and blue. Then the gif repeats, and you see the little boy again, blowing the bubbles into the sky. The boy, the bubbles, the sky. The boy, bubbles, sky. When I get home, even Mum notices that something's changed. And she tries half-heartedly to get it out of me, but I just end up back in my room. I walk around for a little bit and then lie down. Charlie comes into my room and asks me what's wrong. Just as I'm about to tell him, I start crying, and it's not even silent tears this time, it's proper bawling, and I hate myself so much for it that it makes me literally barricade my face from the air with my arms and cry so hard that I stop breathing properly. I've got to do something, I keep saying. I've got to do something. Do something about what? Asks Charlie, clutching his knees to his chest. Just, I don't know, everything's gone crazy. Everyone's gone crazy. I've ruined everything with Becky, and I keep ruining everything with Michael, and I don't even know who Lucas is, not really. My life was so normal before. I used to hate being so bored, but I want that back. I didn't care about anything before. But then, on Saturday, all those people, like, no one gave a single shit about it. They didn't care that Ben Hope could have been kicked to death, and I know he wasn't, but like, I can't be like that anymore. I know it doesn't make any sense. I know I'm probably just stressing about nothing. I know I'm shit. I'm a ridiculous excuse for a human being. But before Solitaire, everything was fine. I was fine. I used to be fine. Charlie just nods. All right. He sits with me while I'm raving and crying, and when I calm down, I pretend I need to sleep, so he goes away. I lie with my eyes open and think about everything that has happened in my entire life, and it doesn't take me very long to get to where I am now. I decide sleeping is impossible. So I start searching through my room for nothing in particular. I find my box of special things in my desk drawer, a box of keepsakes, I guess. And on the top is a diary that I kept in the summer of year 7. I read the first page. Sunday, 24th of August. Up at the crack of 10:30 a.m., Becky et moi went to the cinema today and saw Pirates of the Caribbean. Is that how you spell it? 2. And OMG, it was so good. Becky thinks Orlando Bloom is the fittest, but I like Johnny Depp best. He is hilarious and brilliant. Then we went to get pizza in the high street. She had Hawaiian, but obviously mine was plain cheese. Yum. She's coming round next week for a sleepover too, which is going to be so, so fun. She says she needs to tell me about a boy that she likes, and we're going to eat so much food and stay up all night and watch films. I put the diary back into the bottom of the drawer and sit calmly for several minutes. Then I get it out again and find a pair of scissors and start shredding it, cutting up the pages and the hard cover, slashing and ripping until there is just a confetti-like pile of paper shavings in my lap. Also in the treasure box is an empty bubbles pot. Becky gave it to me for my birthday a long time ago. I used to love bubbles, even if I could never let go of the fact that they are always empty inside. And then I remember the gif on the Solitaire blog. That's another thing then. Another thing to add to the list. The violin video and Star Wars, all that bullshit. I look at the bubbles pot, feeling nothing. Or everything. I don't know. No. I do know. Michael was right. He's been right this whole time. Solitaire. Solitaire is talking to me. Michael was right. It doesn't make any sense, but I know it's me. It's all been about me. I run into the bathroom and throw up. When I return, I shove away the box, shut the drawer, and open another. This one is full of stationery. I test out all my pens with wild squiggles on the pieces of paper and chuck those that don't work under my bed, which is most of them. I'm humming loudly to cover up the sounds I'm hearing from the window, because I know that I'm making them up. My eyes keep tearing up, then calming down, then tearing up again, and I keep rubbing them so hard that I see sparkles even when they're open. I grab the scissors again and spend at least half an hour sitting in front of my mirror and trimming my split ends obsessively. Then I find a big black marker and I get this sudden urge to write something. So on my own arm in the big black marker, I write, "I am Victoria Annabelle Spring." Partly because I can't think of anything else to write, and partly because I'm feeling as if I need to remind myself that I actually have a middle name. Solitaire is talking to me. Maybe deliberately, maybe not. But I've decided it's on me now to do something about it. It's all on me. I move to my bedside table. I take out a few old pens and a few books I haven't read, and my makeup wipes and my current diary, which I do not write in anymore. I open it up, read a few of the entries, and close it again. It's very sad, very cliché teenager. I disgust myself. I close my eyes and hold my breath for as long as possible. 46 seconds. I cry. Consistently and pathetically for a full 23 minutes. I turn on my laptop and scroll through my favourite blogs. I don't post anything on my own blog. I can't remember the last time I did that. Chapter 8. It's been a weird weekend. Not really knowing what to do, I stayed in bed for most of it. Scrolling through the internet, watching TV, etc., etc. Nick and Charlie came to have a chat after lunch on Sunday and made me feel pretty bad for being a lazy slob. So my weekend concludes with Nick and Charlie dragging me to a local music festival at the Clay, which is a grassless field just over the river bridge, bordered by a scattering of trees and broken fences. Nick and Charlie and I walk across the mud toward the crowd surrounding the stage. It's not quite snowing yet, but I can feel it coming. Whoever thought that January was a good month for a music festival is probably a sadist. The band, apparently some London indie band, is so loud that you can hear them from the other end of the high street. While there aren't any actual lights, every other person appears to be holding a torch or carrying a glow stick, and toward the edge of the field is a violent bonfire. I feel significantly underprepared. I think about running back over the bridge and back up the high street and all the way home. No. No running home. "Are you all right?" shouts Charlie over the music. He and Nick are several paces ahead, Nick with a torch shining in my direction, blinding me. "Are you sticking with us?" Nick points at the stage. "We're going to go watch." "No," I say. Charlie just looks at me as I walk off. Nick pulls him away and they disappear into the crowds. I disappear into the crowd too. There are so many people here that I'm actually warm, and I can't see much. Just the green and yellow of glow sticks and the lights of the stage. This band has been on for at least half an hour, and the clay is now more like the swamp. Mud splatters my jeans. I keep seeing people I know from school, and every time I do, I give them a large, sarcastic wave. In the middle of the crowd, Evelyn shakes me by the shoulders and screams that she's looking for her boyfriend. It really makes me dislike her. After a while, I realize that I keep treading on bits of paper. They're literally everywhere. I'm alone in the crowd when I decide to pick one up and look at it properly, lighting it up with my phone torch. It's a flyer, black background. There is a symbol in the middle in red, an upside-down heart drawn in a scrawly sort of way so that it looks like an uppercase A with a circle around it. So that it sort of looks like the symbol for anarchy. Beneath the symbol is the word Friday. My hands begin to shake. Before I have time to think any more about what this might mean, I'm pushed right next to Becky, where she's jumping up and down near the barrier with Lauren and Rita. We catch eyes. Lucas is there too, behind Rita. He's wearing this shirt with little metal edges on the collar, underneath a granddad jumper and a large denim jacket. He is also wearing Vans and rolled black jeans. Just looking at him makes me feel really sad. I shove the Friday flyer into my coat pocket. He sees me over Rita's shoulder and kind of cowers backward, which must be pretty difficult in a crowd as packed as this. I point at my chest, not dropping my eyes. Then I point at him. Then I point toward the empty end of the field. When he doesn't move, I grab him by the arm and start to pull him backward, out and away from the crowds and the throbbing speakers. I'm reminded of when we were 10, or 9, or 8, in a similar situation. Me pulling Lucas along by the arm. He never did anything by himself. I was always very good at doing things by myself. I guess I sort of enjoyed looking after him. There comes a point, though, when you can't keep looking after other people anymore. You have to start looking after yourself. Then again, I guess I don't do either of those things. "What are you doing here?" he asks. We've broken out from the crowd and stopped a little way in front of the bonfire. Various groups of people wander past with drink bottles in their hands, laughing, though the area around the fire is largely empty. "I'm doing things now," I say. I take hold of his shoulder and lean forward, quite seriously. "Why? When did you turn into a hipster?" He gently removes my hand from his shoulder. "I'm serious," he says. The band has stopped. There is momentary quiet, the air filled only with voices merging into one swirling noise. There are several of those flyers at my feet. "I sat outside the cafe for a whole hour," I say, hoping to make him feel really bad. "If you don't tell me now why you're avoiding me, then, like, we might as well just get it over with and stop being friends." He stiffens and turns red, even visible in the dim light. It dawns on me that we're never going to be best friends again. "It's," he says, "it is very difficult for me to be around you." "Why?" It takes him a while to answer. He smooths his hair to one side and rubs his eye and checks that his collar isn't turned up and scratches his knee. And then he starts to laugh. "You're so funny, Victoria." He shakes his head. "You're just so funny." At this, I get a sudden urge to punch him in the face. Instead, I descend into hysteria. "For fuck's sake, what are you talking about?" I begin to shout, but you can't really tell over the noise of the crowd. "You're insane. I don't know why you're saying any of this to me. I don't know why you decided you wanted to be BFFs all over again, and now I don't know why you won't even look me in the eye. I don't understand anything you're doing or saying, and it's killing me, because I already don't understand a single thing about me, or Michael, or Becky, or my brother, or anything on this shitty planet."
If you secretly hate me or something, you need to spit it out. I am asking you to give me one straight answer, one sentence that might sort at least something out in my head. But no, you don't care, do you? You don't give a single shit for my feelings or anyone else's. You're just like everyone else. You're wrong, he says. You're wrong. Everyone's got such dreadful problems. I shake my head wildly, holding onto it with both hands. I start speaking in a posh voice for no reason. Even you, even perfect, innocent Lucas has problems. He's staring at me in a kind of terrified confusion, and it's absolutely hilarious. I start to crack up. Maybe, like, everyone I know has problems. Like there are no happy people. Nothing works out, even when it's someone who you think is perfect, like my brother. I grin wildly at him. My brother, my little brother, he's so perfect, but he doesn't like food. Like, literally doesn't like food. Or, I don't know, he loves it. He loves it so much that it has to be perfect all the time, you know? I grab Lucas by one shoulder again so he understands. And then one day, he got so fed up with himself, he was so annoyed, he hated how much he loved food, yeah? So he thought it would be better if there wasn't any food. I start laughing so much that my eyes water. But that's so silly, because you've got to eat food or you'll die, won't you? So my brother Charlie, he thought it would be better if he just got it over with then and there. So he, last year, he... I hold up my wrist and point at it. He hurt himself. And he wrote me this card, telling me he was really sorry and all, but I shouldn't be sad because he was actually really happy about it. I shake my head and laugh and laugh. And you know what just makes me want to die? The fact that, like, all that time, I knew it was coming. But I didn't do anything. I didn't even say anything to anyone about it because I thought I'd been imagining it. Well, didn't I get a nice surprise when I walked into the bathroom that day? There are tears running down my face. And you know what's literally hilarious? The card had a picture of a cake on it. He's not saying anything, and he doesn't find it hilarious, which strikes me as odd. He makes this pained sound and turns at a sharp right angle and strides away. I wipe the tears of laughter from my eyes, and then I take that flyer out of my pocket and look at it. But the music has started again, and I'm too cold, and my brain doesn't seem to be processing anything. Only that goddamn picture of that goddamn cake. Chapter 9. Victoria! Tori, are you there? Somebody is talking to me on the phone. Where are you? Are you all right? I am alone on the outskirts of the crowd. The music is gone. Everyone is waiting for the next band. And more people begin to join the crush. And it only takes a minute or two for me to be once again trapped in the heaving masses of bodies. The ground is covered in those flyers, and people have started to pick them up. Everything is happening very fast. I'm fine, I say at last. Charlie, I'm fine. I'm just on the field. Okay, good. Nick and I are heading back to the car now. You need to come too. There's a rustling as Nick takes the phone from Charlie. Tori, listen to me. You need to get back to the car right now. But I can barely hear Nick. I can barely hear Nick because something else is happening. There is a huge LED screen on the stage. Up until this point, it has been displaying decorative moving shapes,
and occasionally the names of the songs being played. Now it's gone black, leaving only the dots of the glow stick spread across the dark crowd. I begin to be jostled closer to the screen, the figures around me irresistibly drawn toward it. I turn away, intending to start to push out of the crowd, and that's when I see it. There's a figure, a boy figure, staring blankly from across the river. Is that Nick? I can't tell. Something's happening, I say into the phone, twisting back toward the screen.
Tori, you need to get back to the car. It's going to get insane out there.
The LED screen changes. It shines pure white, then blood red, then back to black.
Tori, hello, can you hear me?
There's a tiny red dot in the center of the screen.
Tori!
It magnifies and takes shape. It's the upside-down heart. The crowd screams as if Beyoncé has just graced the stage. I press the red button on my phone. And then a distorted, genderless voice begins.
Good evening, solitarians.
Everyone puts their arms in the air and shrieks, with glee, with fear. I don't know anymore, but they're loving it. Bodies edge forward, crushing against one another. Everyone's sweating, and soon I'm struggling even to breathe.
Are we having a good time?
The ground vibrates as the voices screech across the air. The flyer I picked up is in my hand. I can't see Lucas, or Becky, or anyone I know. I need to get out. I throw my elbows outward and turn 180 degrees and begin to barge my way through the howling crowd.
We've popped in to tell you about a special event we're planning.
I push against the bodies, but I don't seem to be moving. They're staring upward at the screen as if hypnotized, shouting indiscernible strings of words. And then I see him again. I peek through the gaps in the heads of the crowd. There, across the river, the boy.
We want it to be a big surprise. This coming Friday, if you attend Harvey Green Grammar School, Higgs School, you had better be on your guard.
I squint, but it's so dark. And the crowd is so loud and so happy and so terrifying, and I can't see who it is. I swivel my body back to the LED screen, elbows and knees digging into me at every angle, and there's a countdown timer now showing, with the days, hours, minutes, and seconds. The crowd has started to fist pump. 4 days, 1 hour, 26 minutes, 52 seconds.
4 days, 1 hour, 26 minutes, 48 seconds. 4 days, 1 hour, 26 minutes, 45 seconds. It's going to be Solitaire's biggest operation yet.
And with that, all at once, at least 20 fireworks go off within the crowd, shooting upward from the bodies like meteors and raining sparks down onto the heads, one of which is only 5 meters away from me. Those closest release petrified screams, jumping backward and away from harm. But most of the screams are still screams of happiness, screams of excitement. The crowd begins to sway and shake and I'm buffeted in every direction, my heart pounding so hard I think I might be dying. Yes. I'm dying. I'm going to die. Until eventually I burst out the edge of the crowd and find myself right on the riverbank. I gaze in horror at the crowd. Fireworks of all shapes and colours are continuously exploding among the bodies. At the edge, I see several people fleeing, one or two on fire. A few feet away, a girl collapses and has to be dragged away by her wailing friends. Most of them seem to be enjoying themselves, though, entranced by the rainbow lights.
Tory Spring!
For a moment, I think it's the solitaire voice speaking. Speaking to me. And my heart stops completely. But it's not. It's him. I hear him scream it. I turn around. He's across the river, which is narrow here, his face lit up by his phone like he's about to tell a scary story. Out of breath, in just a t-shirt and jeans. He begins to wave at me. I swear to God he must have an internal central heating system. I stare across at Michael. He's got a flask of something in one hand.
Is that tea?
I shout. He raises the flask and studies it, as if he'd forgotten all about it. He looks back at me and his eyes sparkle and he bellows into the night.
Tea is the elixir of life.
A fresh wave of screams ripples through the group near me and I spin around, only to find people backing away, squealing and pointing at a small light on the ground only 2 steps away from me. A small light slowly fizzling toward a cylinder dug into the ground.
We would especially like to thank the Clay Festival Committee, who definitely did not allow us to be here.
It takes me precisely 2 seconds to realize that if I do not move, a firework is going to go off in my face.
Tory!
Michael's voice is all around me. I seem to be incapable of movement.
Tory, jump into the river right now!
I turn my head toward him. It's almost tempting to just accept my fate and be done with it. His face is locked in an expression of pure terror. He pauses, and then he jumps into the river. It is 0 degrees out here.
Holy,
I say before I can stop myself.
Shit.
Keep an eye on the blog. And keep an eye on each other. You are all important. Patience kills.
The light is nearing the cylinder. I have perhaps 5 seconds. 4.
Tory, jump into the river!
The screen cuts to black, and the shrieking reaches its highest point. Michael is wading toward me, one hand outstretched. One holding his flask over his head. My only option.
Tory!
I leap from the bank into the river. Everything seems to slow. Behind me, the firework explodes. As I'm in midair, I see its reflection in the water. Yellows and blues and greens and purples dancing across the waves. And it's almost beautiful. But only almost. I land with a splash so cold that my legs nearly give way. And then I feel the pain on my left arm. I look at it. I take in the flames creeping up my sleeve. I hear Michael scream something, but I don't know what. And I plunge my arm into the icy water.
Oh my God!
Michael is wading out, holding his flask over his head. The river is at least 10 meters wide.
Sweet, merciful fuck, it is freezing!
And remember, solitarians, justice is everything.
The voice cuts out. Across the river, the crowds are hurrying through town to their cars.
Are you all right? Shouts Michael.
I hesitantly lift my arm from the water. My coat sleeve is entirely burned away. And my jumper and shirt sleeves are in tatters. The skin peeking through is bright red. I press on it with my other hand. It hurts. A lot. Holy fucking shit. Michael tries to wade faster, but I can see him physically shaking. I step forward, farther into the river, my body vibrating uncontrollably, maybe from the cold. Or maybe from the fact that I just escaped death. Or maybe from the searing pain in my arm. I start to mumble deliriously.
We'll kill ourselves. We're both killing ourselves.
He cracks a grin. He's about halfway. The water is up to his chest.
Well, hurry up then. I don't feel like dying of hypothermia today.
The water has risen to my knees. Or maybe I've stepped forward again.
Are you drunk?
He raises his arms above his head and screams.
I am the soberest individual on this whole planet.
The water's at my waist.
Am I walking forward?
He's 2 meters away.
I'm just going out, he calls in a sing-song voice. I may be some time.
Then, Mother of God, I literally am going to freeze to death. I am thinking exactly the same thing.
What's wrong with you? He asks.
No need to shout now.
You just stood there.
I nearly died, I say, not really hearing him properly.
I think I might be going into shock.
The firework.
It's okay. You're okay now. He lifts my arm and takes a look at it. He swallows and tries not to swear.
Okay, you're okay.
There are people. There are lots of hurt people.
Hey.
He finds my other hand in the water and bends a little so our eyes are parallel.
It's okay. Everyone's going to be okay. We'll go to the hospital.
Friday, I say. Solitaire is on Friday.
We look back and the sight is magnificent. It is raining flyers. They're hailing down into the crowd from the large fans set up on stage, and the fireworks are still erupting across the field, each one eliciting a wave of shrieks from the festival goers.
It's a storm, an honest-to-God storm. The sort of storm you go outside in just for the thrill of the risk of death.
I've been looking for you, I say. I cannot feel most of my body. For some reason, he puts his hand on either side of my face and leans forward and says,
Tory Spring, I have been looking for you forever.
The fireworks keep going, never ending, and Michael's face keeps flashing in rainbow colours, and the light gleams from his glasses, and several flyers swirl around us like we're trapped in a hurricane. And the black water strangles us, and we're so close. And there are people shouting at us and pointing, but I really couldn't give a crap. And the cold has dissolved into some kind of numb ache, but it barely registers, and I think the tears freeze on my cheeks, and I don't really know what happens. But through some kind of planetary force, I find myself holding him like I don't know what else to do. And he's holding me like I'm sinking. And I think he kisses the top of my head. But it might just be a snowflake. But he definitely whispers, Nobody cries alone. Or it might have been, Nobody dies alone. And I feel that as long as I stay here, then there might be some kind of tiny chance that there is something remotely good in this world. And the last thing I remember thinking before I pass out from the cold is that if I were to die, I would rather be a ghost than go to heaven. Chapter 10. I think that it might be Monday. Last night was a blur. I remember waking up on the riverbank in Michael's arms. I remember the icy sting of the water and the smell of his t-shirt. And I remember running away. I think that I'm scared of something, but I can't tell what it is. I don't know what to say. I went to A&E, Nick and Charlie made me. I've got a big bandage on my arm now. But it's okay. It doesn't really hurt much at the moment. I have to take it off this evening and put this cream stuff on it. I am not looking forward to that. It sort of reminds me about solitaire every time I look at it. It reminds me what this group is capable of. Everyone looks very happy today, and I don't like it. The sun is out on a murderous rampage, and I had to wear sunglasses on my way to school because the sky, a great flat swimming pool, is trying to drown me. I sit in the common room and Rita asks me what happened to my arm, and I tell her that solitaire did it. She asks if I'm all right. The question makes me tear up, so I tell her that I'm fine and run away. I'm fine. I get flashes of life around me. Some a non-group of girls leaning back in their chairs. Some year 12 looking out of the window while her friends laugh around her. A laminated picture of a mountain featuring the word ambition. A blinking light. But I think what calms me down is my knowledge that I am going to find out who Solitaire is and what it is planning for Friday, and I am going to stop it. By break time, I have counted 66 Solitaire posters in the school, reading, "Friday, justice is coming." Kent, Zelda, and the prefects are in an uproar, and you can no longer pass through a corridor without being overtaken by one of them as they snatch posters from the walls, muttering angrily to themselves. Today, there are two new posts on the Solitaire blog. A photograph of last week's assembly where a Solitaire poster popped up on the projection screen, and a picture of the Virgin Mary. I will print both of these out and stick them on my bedroom wall, where I have already stuck all of Solitaire's previous posts. My wall is nearly completely covered. First, Solitaire beat up a boy, and then it seriously injured a bunch of people, all for the purpose of putting on a good show. And everybody in the town is absolutely in love with it. It is clear to me now that if I do not stop Solitaire, nobody else will. At lunch, I sense that I am being followed, but when I reach the IT department, I reckon I've outsmarted them. I take a seat in C15, the room directly opposite C16, where I met Michael. There are three people with me in the room. Some year 13 is scrolling down the University of Cambridge website, and a pair of year 7s are playing the impossible quiz with immense concentration. They don't notice me. I boot up the computer and scroll up and down the Solitaire blog for 45 minutes. At some point, my follower walks into C15. It's Michael, obviously. Still feeling guilty for running away again, and unwilling to talk about it, I dive past him and out of the room, and begin to walk swiftly in no particular direction. He catches up to me. We're walking very fast. "What are you doing?" I ask. "I'm walking," says Michael. We turn a corner. "Maths," he says. "We're in the maths corridor. They make the displays so beautiful here, because otherwise no one would like maths. Why would people think that maths is fun? All maths does is give you a false sense of achievement." Kent exits a classroom a few paces ahead of us. "All right, Mr. Kent," says Michael. Kent gives him a vague nod and passes by us. "I definitely think he writes poetry," Michael continues. "You can tell, in his eyes and the way he folds his arms all the time." I come to a halt. We've made a full circle around Higgs's second floor. We stay very still, sort of looking at each other. He has a mug of tea in his hand. There's a weird moment when I think we both want to hug each other. but I quickly end it by turning around and walking back into C15. I sit at the computer I'd been staring at, and he takes the seat next to me.
"You ran off again," he says.
I don't look at him.
"You didn't reply to my texts last night after you ran off," he says. "I had to Facebook message Charlie to find out what had happened to you."
I say nothing.
"Did you get my texts? My voicemails? I was kind of worried you'd caught hypothermia or something. And your arm. I was really worried."
"I don't remember there being any texts or voicemails. I remember Nick shouting at me for being an idiot, and Charlie sitting next to me in the back rather than next to Nick in the passenger seat. I remember arriving at A&E and waiting for hours. I remember Nick falling asleep on Charlie's shoulder, and Charlie and I playing 20 questions, and him winning every time. I remember not sleeping last night. I remember telling Mum that I would be going to school, and that was final."
"What are you doing?" he asks.
"What am I doing? I am thinking. I am looking at myself in the black computer monitor. I'm doing something. About solitaire.
Since when are you interested in solitaire?"
"Since..." I go to answer him, but I don't know the answer. He doesn't frown, or smile, or anything.
"Why wouldn't I be interested?" I ask. "You're interested. You're the one who said that solitaire was targeting me."
"I just thought you weren't," he says, his voice a little wobbly. "It's not like you to... I just didn't think...
You didn't care that much, you know, originally."
"That may be true."
"You're still interested, right?"
I ask, scared of the answer. Michael looks at me for a long time.
"I'd like to know who's behind it all," he says. "And I know what happened to Ben Hope was pretty nasty, and then last night. I mean, that was just downright idiotic. It's a miracle nobody died. Did you see the article on BBC News? The Clay Festival are passing it off as if it was their final show gone wrong, or something. Solitaire didn't even get a mention. I guess the Clay Festival organisers didn't want anyone to know they'd been hijacked.
And who's going to listen to a bunch of kids going on about some blog that organised it?"
Michael's staring at me as if he's scared of me. I must have a very strange expression on my face. He tilts his head.
"When was the last time you slept?"
I don't bother to answer. We sit silent for a moment before he tries again.
"You know, this is a very generic thing to say, but..."
He pauses.
"If you want to, talk about anything, like, you know... People always need people to talk to. You don't talk much.
I'm always here, like, to talk.
You do know that, don't you?"
The sentence is so broken up that I don't really grasp its concept, so I just nod enthusiastically. Judging by his slightly relieved smile, that seems to satisfy him. At least until he goes on to ask,
"Are you going to tell me why you've changed your mind? Why you're being obsessive?"
It hasn't struck me that I am obsessing. I don't think that's the word I'd use.
"Someone has to."
"Why?"
"It's important. No one cares about the important things anymore."
I drift off.
"We're so used to disaster that we accept it. We think we deserve it."
His smile, fleeting, fades.
"I don't think anyone deserves disaster. I think a lot of people wish for disaster because it's the only thing left with the power to turn heads."
"Attention seekers?"
Some people don't get any attention, he says. And here again is the boy from the ice rink. Serious, genuine, morose, old, and silently angry. Some people get no attention. You can understand why they'd go seeking it, if they're waiting forever for something that might never come. I feel suddenly like I'm blind, or perhaps deaf, losing track of the conversation. He starts fishing for something in his bag and after a few moments withdraws a can, holding it out to me. It's a really obscure brand of diet lemonade, one of my favourites. He smiles, but it's forced. I was at the shop and thought of you. I look at the can, feeling something very strange in my stomach. Thanks. Another long pause. You know, I say, when that firework was about to go off, I actually thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to burn and die. He gazes at me. But you didn't. He really is a good person. Far too good to be hanging around someone like me. I almost laugh at myself for thinking something so cliché. I think I've said before how things are cliché because they are true. Well, there's one thing that I know is true, and that is that Michael Holden is too good for me. Later, 7 p.m, dinner. Mum and Dad are out somewhere. Nick and Charlie are at opposite ends of the table. I am next to Oliver. We are eating pasta with some meat in it. I'm not sure what the meat is. I cannot concentrate. Tori, what's the matter? Charlie waves his fork at me. What's going on? Something's going on. Solitaire is going on, I say. Yet no one cares. Everyone is sitting around talking about things that do not matter and pretending that it's still some big hilarious joke. Nick and Charlie look at me like I'm crazy. Well, I am. It's pretty weird that solitaire hasn't been reported on, I guess, says Nick. Like, even with that stuff at the clay, solitaire didn't even come into it. People don't seem to be taking solitaire seriously. Charlie sighs, cutting him off. Whether solitaire does or does not pull off something spectacular, there's no reason for Tori or anyone else to get involved. It's not our problem, is it? Shouldn't the teachers, or like, the police be doing something about it? It's their own fault for not bothering to do anything. And that's when I know I've lost him as well. I thought that you two were better than all this. Or what? Charlie raises his eyebrows. All this stuff that people spend their time bothering with. I scrunch up my hands, placing them on my head. It's all fake. Everyone is faking. Why does no one care about anything? Tori, seriously, are you all right? Yes! I probably scream. Yes, I'm all right, thanks. How about you? And then I get myself out of there just before I start to cry. Obviously, Charlie told Mum and Dad. When they get home, I'm not sure what time, they knock on my door. When I don't answer, they come in. What? I say. I am sitting upright on my bed and have been trying to choose a film to watch for the last 37 minutes. On the television, some news guy is talking about the suicide of a Cambridge student. And my laptop is on my legs, like a sleeping cat. My blog homepage emitting its dim blue glow. Mum and Dad take a long look at my back wall. You can't see any parts of the paint anymore. It's just a patchwork sheet of solitaire printouts. Hundreds of them. What's the matter, Tori? Asks Dad, averting his eyes from the display. I do not know. Did you have a bad day? Yes, always. Come on now, there's no need to be so melodramatic.
Mum sighs, apparently disappointed in something.
Cheer up, smile.
I make a fake hurling sound.
Dear God.
Mum sighs again. Dad imitates her.
Well, we'll leave you to your misery then, he says, if you're going to be sarcastic.
Ha ha, sarcastic.
They roll their eyes and leave. I start to feel sick. I think it's my bed. I don't know. I don't even know. So my ingenious solution for this is for me to pathetically flop off my bed and onto the floor, propping myself sluggishly up against my solitaire wall. My room is half dark. Friday, 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 Friday.
Chapter 11.
Mum, I say, it's Tuesday, 7:45 a.m., and I have no scare. This is one of those situations where talking to my mum is unavoidable. Mum, can you iron my school skirt?
Mum doesn't say anything because she's on the kitchen computer in her dressing gown.
You'd think she was ignoring me deliberately, but she really is that engrossed in whatever dumb email she's writing.
Mum,
I say again.
Mum, 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 ma,
what?
Can you iron my school skirt?
Can't you wear the other one?
It's too small. It's been too small since we bought it.
Well, I'm not ironing your school skirt. You iron it.
I have never ironed anything in my life. I have to leave in 15 minutes.
That's annoying.
Yes, it is, Mum.
She doesn't answer me. Jesus Christ.
So I guess I'm going to school with no skirt.
I guess you are.
I grate my teeth together. I have to catch a bus in 15 minutes and I'm still in my pyjamas.
Do you care? I ask. Do you care that I have no skirt?
At the moment, Tori, no. It's in the airing cupboard. It's just a bit crinkled.
Yeah, I found it. It's supposed to be a pleated skirt, Mum. Currently, there are no pleats.
Tori, I'm really busy.
But I don't have a skirt to wear to school.
Wear your other skirt then, for Christ's sake.
I literally just told you it's too small.
Tori, I really don't care.
I stop talking. I look at her. I wonder if I'll end up like her, not caring whether my daughter has a skirt to wear to school. And then I realise something.
You know what, Mum? I say, starting to actually laugh at myself.
I don't even think I care either.
So I go upstairs and put on my grey school skirt that is too small, and put my old PE shorts on over my tights so you can't see anything. And then I attempt to sort out my hair, but oh, guess what? I don't care about that either. And then I go to put some makeup on, but no. Wait, I also do not care what my face looks like. So I go back downstairs and pick up my school bag and leave the house with Charlie, basking in the light and glory that comes with not giving a damn about anything in the entire universe. I'm feeling kind of like a ghost today. I sit on a swivel chair in the common room, fiddling with the bandage on my arm, and watch, out the window, some year sevens chucking snowballs at one another. They're all smiling.
Tori, calls Becky from a little way across the room. I need to talk to you.
Begrudgingly, I rise from the chair and weave through the sixth form crowd to get to her.
Wouldn't it be nice to be able to walk through people?
How's your arm? She asks. She's acting super awkward. I'm past that now. I'm past awkward.
Why should I care what anyone thinks anymore? Why should I care about anything anymore?
It's fine, I say, an obligatory answer to an obligatory question.
Look, I'm not going to apologize, yeah? I wasn't in the wrong.
She talks as if she's blaming me for being angry at her.
I'm just going to come out and say what we've both been thinking.
She stares me straight in the eye.
We haven't been acting like friends recently, have we?
I say nothing.
And I'm not just talking about after what happened at... What happened? It's been going on for months. It's like you really don't want to be friends with me. It's like you don't like me.
It's not that I don't like you, I say. But I don't know how to continue. I don't know what it is.
If we can't act like friends, then there's no real point in us carrying on being friends.
As she's saying this, her eyes get a little watery. I can't think of anything to say. I met Becky on the first day of year 7. We sat next to each other in form and in science. We passed notes and we played MASH, and I helped her decorate her locker with pictures of Orlando Bloom. She lent me money for cookies at break time. She always spoke to me, even though I was one of the quiet ones. 5.5 years later, here we are.
I don't think that we are compatible, she says. I don't think that it is possible for us to be friends anymore.
You have changed. I might have changed too, but you have definitely changed, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's true. So is it my fault we're not friends anymore? Becky doesn't react.
I'm not sure that you need me anymore.
Why is that?
You don't like being around me, do you?
I laugh, exasperated, and I forget everything else except her and Ben. Her and Ben. Her and the guy who beat up my brother.
Are you trying to gain sympathy here? Are you breaking up with me? This isn't a rom-com, Becky. We are not in a lesbian drama.
She frowns, disappointed.
You're not taking me seriously. Stop with all this crap, she says. Just stop, yeah? Cheer up. I know you're a pessimist. I've known you for 5 years, but this is getting out of hand. Go and hang around with Michael some more.
What? I scoff.
So he can fix me. So he can teach me how to stop being me.
I laugh loudly.
He shouldn't be hanging around with someone like me.
She stands up.
You should try and find people who are more like you. They'll be better for you.
There is no one like me.
I think you're breaking down.
I cough loudly.
I'm not a car.
And she is furious. Like Jesus, actual rage is steaming from her face. It takes all her effort not to shout her last word.
Fine.
Becky thunders over to a crowd who I used to consider myself part of. I should feel like I have lost something, but the feeling inside my blood retains the same density of nothing. I start listening to my iPod, some sad album. Something really self-pitying. And I roll over facts in my head. The top post on the Solitaire blog today is a screen cap from Fight Club. Charlie couldn't eat this morning. He cried when I tried to make him. So I gave up. It was probably my fault for being angry at him yesterday. I have 3 unread texts from Michael Holden and 26 unread messages on my blog. It's later. I've come back to C16, the decaying computer room on the 2nd floor where I found that post-it note. I can tell that nobody has been in here. The sun lights up the dust floating in the air. As I'm looking out of the window, my face pressed against the glass, I notice that there is a tall metal staircase just outside to my left.
its top step parallel to the window I'm staring through. It leads onto the concrete roof of the Art Conservatory, a newly built classroom that juts out from the ground floor and spirals all the way down to the ground. I don't think I've ever seen this staircase before. I exit C16, trot down to the ground floor, go outside, and scale the metal staircase all the way to the top. Even though I'm not on the roof of the school itself, standing on the roof of the Art Conservatory is fairly dangerous, being at second floor level. I sneak a look down onto the grass below. The grass slopes down slightly from the room onto the field. I look out. The slushy field opens out into the distance. The river slowly tumbles on. I sit down so that my legs are hanging off the edge. No one can see or find me here. It's period four, nearly lunchtime, and I'm skipping music for the 100th time. It doesn't matter. I bring up the solitaire blog on my phone. The countdown timer is at the top of the screen. I find myself checking it continually. 02, 12, 23, 26. 2 days, 12 hours, 23 minutes, 26 seconds, until Thursday turns into Friday. Solitaire antics today have been focused around the number 2. Hundreds of posters on post-its on every surface, written on all whiteboards, popping up on the computers. From here, I can see that the number 2 is painted in red directly onto the snow of the field. It looks a bit like blood. A little way away from the number 2 on the field is a large wooden object. I stand up and step backward. I realize that it's Kent's lectern, from which he leads our school assemblies. A small congregation of students has gathered outside, staring, like me, clearly waiting for something exciting to happen. At the front of the crowd, Quiffguy is standing with a camera in his hands. I fold my arms, my blazer flaps out behind me in the wind. I suppose I look very dramatic, standing here on the roof. Painted on the front of the lectern is Solitaire's anarchy symbol. Its face, the side that Kent would stand at when speaking, is directed away from us, staring wistfully out over the snowy field and down into the town and river beyond. Music, Ludovico Einaudi, begins to play out of the outside loudspeaker, blending into the sigh of a steady breeze. A piece of paper, one of Kent's past assemblies, clipped onto the lectern somehow, lifts up and flickers as the wind encircles it, as if it is gesturing, "Come here," to the town and the river. Then the lectern catches fire. It's over in less than 30 seconds, but it feels longer. A spark from its base sends the entire wooden body into flames, and the flames double the size of the lectern, magnifying it, expanding it. It's sort of beautiful. The reddish orange of the spectacle sends a dim glow across the snow, so that the entire field is slightly alight, wavering up and down. The wind is so strong that the fire begins to vortex around the wood, shooting shards of blackened charcoal outward in every direction, a tunnel of smoke coughing upward. Slowly, the darkness creeps across the pale wood. It cracks. The lectern takes its last lingering look out at what freedom might have been. Then all at once, the entire frame crumbles into a destroyed heap, and the once blazing fire subsides. What is left is little more than a pile of soot and ash. I am paralyzed. The scattering of students on the field are shrieking and screaming, but not with fear. One small girl steps out and retrieves a broken piece of the lectern, bringing it back to her friends.
Teachers begin to show, barking reprimands and shooing people away. And I watch as a girl drops a piece of lectern upon the snow. Once the field is clear, I tear down the stairs and run across the snow to rescue it. I study the piece of burnt wood. I then stare back toward the pile of remains, then the greyish snow, then the long and omnipresent river, and then I think about the sea of anonymous students who had been so excited to watch this. It reminds me of the people who watched the beating up of Ben Hope, jeering, laughing at pain. The crowd that had jumped up and down like children at the fireworks at the clay, while the injured ran, terrified, burning. I close my fist. The piece of wood dissolves into black dust. Chapter 12. When I get to school on Wednesday, I watch out for Michael Holden in the common room crowds. I wonder whether seeing him will make me feel better or worse. It could go either way. I know I'm dragging him down. Seeing me cannot make Michael Holden feel better. He deserves to have a friend who loves life and laughter, who loves having fun and having adventures, someone to drink tea with and argue about a book and stargaze and ice skate and dance with. Someone who isn't me. Becky, Lauren, Evelyn and Rita are sitting in our spot in the corner. No Ben, no Lucas. Like the beginning of the year all over again. I stand at the door to the common room, kind of staring at them. Evelyn is the only one who sees me. She catches my eye, then quickly looks away. Even if I could quietly overlook her exceedingly irritating hair and clothing choices, like a decent and accepting human being should, Evelyn has always done many things that I have not approved of, such as thinking she is better than other people and pretending to know more than she does. I wonder whether she dislikes me as much as I dislike her. I take a seat in a swivel chair away from our lot, thinking about all my personal attributes. Pessimist, mood killer, unbearably awkward and probably paranoid, deluded, nasty, borderline insane, manically depressed psychopath. Tori! I spin around on the chair. Michael Holden's found me. I look up at him. He's smiling, but it looks weird. Fake. Or am I imagining that? It's Wednesday today, I say instantly, unwilling to build up our conversation with small talk, but doing it anyway. He blinks, but doesn't act too taken aback. Yes. Yes, it is. I suppose, I say, curling onto the desk with my cheek on my arm. I don't like Wednesdays because it's the middle day. You feel like you've been at school for ages, but it's still ages until the weekend. It's the most disappointing day. As he takes this in, something else kind of weird crosses his expression. Almost like panic or something. He coughs. Can we, talk somewhere quieter? I really do not want to have to get up. But he persists. Please, I've got some news. As we're walking, I stare into the back of his head. In fact, I just stare at his whole body. I've always thought of Michael Holden as this kind of entity, this sparkling orb of wonder. And yet now, looking at him walking along in his average school uniform, hair kind of soft and messy compared to how he had it gelled when I first met him, I find myself thinking about the fact that he's just a normal guy. That he gets up and goes to bed. That he listens to music and watches TV. That he revises for exams and probably does homework, that he sits down to dinner, that he showers and brushes his teeth. Normal stuff. What am I talking about? He takes me to the school library. It's not as quiet as he'd hoped. There are lower school girls swarming around the desks in exactly the same way.